Welcome to the Bad Apples Season 2, Episode 1. In this episode, we are going to install Linux on the Mac. Now, if you have been following along with the Bad Apples all through Season 1, if you've been using the Fink project, you've been in the X11 environment, Linux is going to be great for you. You're going to love it. It's not unlike using the Fink project and hanging out in X11. In fact, you're very often in X11. That's your primary desktop environment in Linux. So if you've got that theory down, using Linux is going to be very natural to you, and actually it's going to be even easier, I think, in many ways than using X11 in macOS, simply because macOS has the default Quartz window manager, that is, that Aqua interface that we deal with. That's the default graphic user interface, and so in order to use X11, you kind of have to, you know, you're using basically one graphical interface on top of another graphical user interface. And in the next episode, where we created the next system, we kind of overrode that with some hidden files in your user profile, the .x session, the .x client files that we created, telling the X11 environment to just go ahead and take over and be our primary graphical user interface. And that worked well for the next system, but we don't have the same software choices that we have on a next system as we will on a real Linux system. The support for just that raw Unix environment on the Mac is simply not what it is for the Linux environment. Linux is a rich landscape of developers and users and enthusiasts, and you just have so much more choice than you ever have on the Mac or Mac under X11. So if you're into the Unix side of things, you're going to love Linux, and it won't be that foreign to you. You'll actually find it very, very familiar. So to get a Linux distribution, it's quite easy. It's, number one, it's free, which makes it quite nice. You do have to know how to burn what's called a disk image or an ISO. And so we're going to go through that, and then we'll go through the installation process. Installing Linux, there are a lot of different ways to do that. You've got a lot of different options. I'm going to try to cover a couple of the more probable options, and we'll go through some of the different ways that you can do that, and which Linux distribution might best suit what you think you're going to be doing, you know, in regards to whether you're going to keep the Mac OS X on the computer and dual boot with Mac and Linux, or whether you're just going to dedicate a computer to Linux, whatever. We'll also have to take a look at the wireless drivers. Wireless cards are notorious for keeping their firmware and their drivers secret, completely secret. They won't share it with anyone. They won't tell anyone how it works. Sometimes they cite, I don't know, some kind of FCC regulation or something, which I'm pretty sure is nonsense. But it makes it very hard for the Linux developers to make software that will talk to the wireless cards when those wireless cards won't reveal anything about how they work. There are some ways around that, and we're going to dip into that today. The Linux that we are going to install, originally I was thinking about doing a Debian install. So Debian is I think I've probably mentioned it in last season, it's a ridiculously stable and secure and rock-solid Linux distribution. People used to say that to me, and I never really understood what they were talking about. But after a while, once I had played around with it on a couple of different computers, tried to install it on really, really old Mac computers like G3, 333 iMacs, things like that. I mean, it would install, and it would give me the flexibility that I needed to customize the install, so it would really, really work really well with that computer, depending on whether it was an old computer or a new computer. So Debian definitely is a great choice if you need to get in there, customize the installation, really kind of tweak it one way or another. Something that you maybe don't need a stock install, although their stock install is great too. It actually, I've installed it onto my iBook G4 in the past, and it's run really, really well. However, last minute I kind of changed my mind and decided that I haven't really had a whole lot of experience with Fedora Linux, which is a very well-respected Linux distribution put out by really one of the older Linux companies still in existence, called Red Hat. And Red Hat is huge in the server space. They have lots of servers in very, very large companies. And as just kind of a side community project, they also put out Fedora. And Red Hat is, it's a very big company, and it's a very big distribution of Linux. It's very important. Big companies purchase long-term support from them. You know, it's a really great sort of Unix industry, just a very model of how it can work well. And Fedora is their kind of sandbox. It's where they kind of play around with ideas that they have to put into the next release of Red Hat. So it's a cool distribution to use, and I hadn't realized that they actually had a PowerPC version of Fedora. And when I found that out, I decided, well, maybe we should try that on this show, because the experiences that I've had with Fedora in the past have been very positive, and I've always meant to try it. So now we're going to try it on this show, and I've certainly been very pleased with it so far. And now let's go out onto the internet and find ourselves a disk. Getting a Linux distribution is, at the easiest, you can buy the disk from a mail order or an online vendor. You can find online vendors at a website called distrowatch.com. Distrowatch.com is a hub of all the latest Linux releases and Linux news. I know that they have some kind of rating system on, like, how many hits each distribution has gotten lately, and that's not really, no one claims, I don't think, that is, you know, accurate to any, you know, actually how many people are using that distribution or how good the distribution is. It's just kind of like, here's how many hits we've gotten on DistroWatch about this distribution. So don't pay too much attention to the rating board. But on DistroWatch, I know that I've always seen companies offering to sell Linux disks for, you know, usually, certainly no more than $17 or $16. It's usually a lot less than that. And the only thing about that is that, you know, they'll burn it for you and make a nice package for you and send it to you. And that's just kind of, that's one way of doing it. I think probably the more typical way of doing it is just going to the site of the distribution that you want to acquire and downloading what's called an ISO. That's a .iso. And that's a disk image file, basically. And you can download that. Usually they're fairly large. Sometimes they're a full CD. Sometimes they're almost a full DVD. Just depends on how much software that Linux distribution is packaging with the operating system that they're providing. So if you download a .iso file, it will probably take you a little while. It's a lot of times best to go for the BitTorrent option, because I usually find that the BitTorrent are pretty active. There's usually a lot of people providing the Linux CD that you're looking for, the DVD that you're looking for, on BitTorrent, and it usually goes faster than trying to get it from a server, you know, hosting the Linux disk at a university or something. You can try, you know, all of those and just see what's faster for you. But to get these disks, I guess the easiest way is to simply go to the site. So the one that we're going to do on the show is Fedora Project org. You can also find, like I say, a really good distribution at debian.org, I think. And that is just a really great distribution, but the installation process maybe is a little bit harder than the Fedora one. But we'll talk about that in a minute. But we're going to do the Fedora project.org. And you're taken to the Fedora page. And just over on the left, there's a link called Get Fedora. And that's what you want. And they give you a choice. Installation media. There's the i386. There's the x86-64. And there's the PPC. And there's the BitTorrent versus the direct download. Like I say, BitTorrent download is usually faster. So I would probably recommend that. And if you're doing this on a PowerPC Mac, you're going to want to get the PPC version. If you're doing this on an Intel Mac, you can use either the i386 or the x86-64. It depends on which Intel Mac you have. So if this is a MacBook or a MacBook Pro or an iMac or a Mac Mini with an Intel Core Duo chip, you need the i386. If you have one of those computers with an Intel Core Duo 2 chip, then you're good to go with the x86-64. In theory, that should be the faster system to use. It's a 64-bit system, which, of course, Leopard has just become a 64-bit Mac OS. So here's a Linux one that's been 64-bit for a little while. And you can use that on your Intel Core Duo 2 chip-based Mac. You can find out what kind of chip it is by going to the Apple menu and going to About This Mac, and it will tell you your processor. I'm using a PowerPC, so G4, G5, G3, those are PowerPC chips. If you're using an Intel Core Duo, you're using a 32-bit Intel. If you're doing Intel Core Duo 2, that is capable of doing either 32 or 64-bit, so you can choose. So for me, I'm going to click on this PowerPC BitTorrent, and it opens up in my BitTorrent client and starts to download from all over the world. So while that downloads, and it may take a while depending on the method of downloading and when you're doing it and where you are and what your bandwidth is like, while that happens, though, let's talk a little bit about the different installation options that we're going to have. Linux installations typically anticipate that you may be installing it onto a computer that you're going to have another operating system on that you may want to keep. So typically, for instance, Mac OS X, the installer for that assumes that you either want to take everything on your system and consolidate it, all your user data, and put it into a folder and install a new system underneath it. That's called the archive and install. Or erase the entire drive and make a new installation. That's usually the default. They don't really make an allowance for the idea that maybe you'll want to have Mac OS X and you'll want to have Linux, or one version of OS X and a previous version of OS X. I mean, you can do it, and we'll talk about how to do that kind of thing, because it actually plays in to the Linux install as well. But it's not really designed for that. Whereas a lot of Linux distributions actually are designed with that in mind. So you'll need to assess what computer you're going to be installing the Linux distribution onto, and you'll need to be aware of, number one, the danger that if you don't know what you are doing, and you may not, then you might screw up your computer to the point where you'll have to erase the entire hard drive and do it all over again. That's not the worst thing in the world, unless you have all your great, wonderful personal data that you don't want to lose. So what I'm trying to say is make sure that you've backed up before you do this. Back up all your data, make sure that anything left on that computer that has not been copied somewhere else is disposable. So if you screw it up and you need to erase the entire drive, you're able to do that. Now, there are a couple of different ways to install Linux. The easiest way, the very, very easiest way, would be simply to install it as the primary operating system. Because then you can just basically click through the installer just like you could on an OS X installer. It will erase the drive and install itself on the drive. And you just won't have to think about repartitioning the drive and how to consolidate the data or how to set up your drive to be an optimal installation for Linux, because Linux is a very flexible system and you can actually set up your drive in a number of different ways and it'll all talk to each other and it'll be very fast and very optimized and very secure. The other way to do it is to go ahead and dual boot with Mac OS X and Linux. And this is probably going to be a fairly common option because most people using a Mac bought the Mac in part for the operating system. And there might be one or two applications like Final Cut Pro or Soundtrack Pro or Maya or something like that that maybe you either don't have an option of replacing in Linux or you're not familiar with the Linux version of it, so you need to maintain that OS X drive, you know, that OS X system on the computer until you get more familiar with the Linux way of doing things. So we'll talk about that option as well. Now, either way, if you are able to go into your disk utilities on the Mac before you really, really start any of this, you'll do yourself a couple of favors. So the best way to do this is to grab your Tiger installation disk or whatever system installer you've got for your Mac, pop it into the drive, restart holding down the C key, which of course will boot up off of that CD or that DVD, and will take you to an installer. Now you might not have known this, but if you're booting off the CD, you also have the option of not installing. You can just bypass the installer, and it has a couple of system tools that you can use just with your system existing off of the CD. One of these is the terminal, one of them resets the password, one of them will give you a disk utility menu. Now don't do this yet, because we're going to revisit this whole process in a little while, but I want to get you familiar with your options first. The disk utility here is the same disk utility as the one in your computer in the utilities folder. It's just that in this case, you'll have the option of doing things without, you know, doing things to your primary disk without also running off of that primary disk. So it's a much better way of using disk utilities for system-wide changes like this. So if you're in disk utilities, you should see that you've got your hard drive up at the top, the actual volume itself, the actual drive, which will be however many gigabytes it is. So on this iBook, it's about a 76 gigabyte drive showing up. Actually, it's a 74.5 gigabyte Hitachi hard drive. And then underneath that is the disk that I've created, which basically is my root system. So it's the mount point is the slash. So that's just the when I go out to the bare bones area of my system, that's what I get. Is that disk partition, which was formatted as macOS extended journaled and has all of my data on it right now. If at all possible, it would be really, really fantastic if you could manage to erase that entire volume. That's a really easy way of doing this. Specifically, you would want to partition that drive. If you click on the partition tab, you'll see that you have a couple of different choices. You can split it in half by giving it two partitions. You can split it into thirds. You'll have three separate partitions. You know, you can really divide that drive up so that the computer sees it basically as two physical hard drives, at least in a sense. I mean, it's not really seeing it as two physical hard drives, but it sees it as two separate drives, two different mount points, basically. So, I'll I've got my macOS 10 drive, and I need to split that into two, and I'll just cut it straight in half. So giving it two partitions, I'll leave the first, if you click on that, the first partition over on the right hand side, we can assign that to be a macOS extended journal drive. Now that bottom one, I have a lot of different choices, but none of these choices are actually suitable for a Linux installation. So the easiest way to do this will be to assign that second partition as free space. Because when we get into the installation of Fedora, we'll be able to just tell Fedora, hey, find all the free space and use it for your system. So if I assign this as free space, the macOS 10 drive will leave that empty and will actually create free, space that is marked free on that drive. Now this is very important because, in fact, so I'll click on repartition so that it's doing that while I talk. But this is, so now it's erasing both of these drives, you understand. This will destroy all of your data. You will have to reinstall macOS 10, and you will have to then, of course, install Linux onto that second partition. So do not do this if you do not want to destroy all of your data on the hard drive. Now, this is important because if we attempt to install Linux without assigning what is free space on the drive, we may have very little free space on the drive for Linux. Even if you think that you've just, well, maybe you've just reinstalled macOS 10 as a fresh install. Believe it or not, even if you tell it to erase the drive first and then do an installation, it doesn't leave all the rest of that drive as, quote, free space. The data that you believe that you've just erased is technically still there. And even if you're telling it erase and reinstall, it's not actually erasing and reinstalling. It's just reinstalling over the portion of that drive that it needs for it to create its macOS 10 system. Even if you go into Disk Utilities before you do this and tell it to erase all free space, still not guaranteed to give you free space. So the only way to do this is to partition the drive and create essentially two volumes or two mount points so that one can be a macOS 10 system and one can be marked as free space so that you can use it. Now the other option that you'll have, again, this is one of the easier ways. If you're going to dual boot between macOS 10 and Linux, this is an easy way. So the easiest way to do it is just to install Linux and erase the entire drive and just use it as a Linux book, a Linux laptop or computer, whatever. The second easiest way is to partition the drive, thereby erasing all of your data anyway, but at least you can install macOS 10 on one volume, Linux on the other volume. The third way to do this, if you're trying to install Linux without touching any of your data, will be not to go into Disk Utility at all. And we'll just go straight into the Linux install, tell it to find what free space it can find, and use that as your Linux installation. That is not the best or easiest way. It's going to give you a lot less room for your Linux install. So if you intend to actually use your Linux installation for any amount of serious work, you're not going to have a very large hard drive to do that on. However, if you're just trying to get a flavor for Linux, maybe you want to test it out, whatever, that would be a fine way to do it. Hey, it looks like the Fedora DVD has finished downloading from BitTorrent. So here it sits on my desktop as a little disk image file. And if I were to double-click on it, of course, it would open up a disk image just as if though we had downloaded an installer for Firefox or Skype or something like that. You know a disk image. You've seen them before. So what we'll have to do is burn that to a CD or a DVD. But there's a very specific way that we have to do this. And macOS 10 gives us built-in support for doing it this way. So what we can do is we go into Disk Utilities again. Now we're doing this off of our hard drive, but this isn't the point where we've booted off of the macOS 10 disk. This is, you know, we've just downloaded the Fedora project, the DVD, and so we're still in our little OS 10 system, and we're going to go and burn this ISO. So in Disk Utilities, on the left-hand column, you see all the drives that are attached to your file system. So right now I've got my 74.5 gigabyte Hitachi hard drive with its single disk, or its single drive mount point. And then I've got two external hard drives, which I'll probably go ahead and unplug right now just to keep them... I'm going to go ahead and eject them just to keep them safe from any harm. And then you may have a disk image there in the left column of the Fedora project. If not, you want to add that Fedora project to that column. And to do that, you simply go out to your desktop, find wherever it downloaded the Fedora installation disk image, and drag that and drop it into the left-hand column. Now you're going to select that disk image in the left-hand column and click the Burn button. The Burn button is the big macOS 10 nuclear burn logo that they always use for burning up in the left-hand corner. Click that, and it will ask you for a blank DVD. Put that into your drive, and it will begin to burn the ISO. So it's burning it in such a way that when you put it into your drive and start up off of your CD drive, it will come up as a live disk, something that you're able to use. So it's not just a standard data disk, it's a bootable system disk, much like your macOS 10 installation disk. And so it'll burn however quickly or slowly it typically burns for you. And let's assume, for the sake of brevity, that it has finished burning, and you'll be left with a Fedora installation disk that you could now boot up off of and install Fedora. So if you're doing it the easy way, if you're just going to wipe your Mac clean and install Fedora onto it, this is the end of the road for you. You pop that disk in, you click Restart, hold down the C key to boot up off the CD drive, and you will be booted into the Fedora installation process, which we'll get to in a minute. You could probably even figure it out yourself. It's pretty simple. It's a pretty straightforward kind of installation process. You click Next a lot, and it continues through the installer until finally it starts installing. Now, only do that, again, if you want to erase your entire disk. If you're having something else in mind, maybe a dual booting system, then you'll want to follow along with me now. So you'll want to eject the Fedora disk, because we're not going to do that yet. First, we need to go out to the disk utility from the OS X installation disk and set up your drive. So do that. You'll find that you have to go in a little ways as if though you were going to just reinstall OS X. There's the greeting screen, which you'll just click through. I think they talk about OS X a little bit. I think they even make you agree to their software license agreement. And finally, after that, once it starts giving you the option of where you want to install the system onto, at that point you should see a menu up at the top. One of the menu selections is either Utilities or Tools, and you'll select that. And in there, you'll see the reset password, you'll see a terminal, you'll see network utility, and you'll also see Disk Utility. So you'll want to go onto Disk Utility, and again, you'll see the same old Disk Utility that you're used to. You'll see your hard drive up at the top, and it's one single mount point as it exists. And from here, since you've booted up off of your installation disk, you can select that drive and do whatever you need to do to it to make it available to your Linux installation disk. So again, if you're going to dual boot and you want it to be about half and half, you will really need to repartition that disk, which will involve erasing the entire OS X information on that drive. You can reinstall OS X, and then you'll have OS X back, but your personal data will be gone forever, so you'll need to back that up first. And once you've done that, you can go ahead and repartition the drive, and you'll be good to go. Remember, the first partition you can create as a Mac partition, macOS Extended Journaled. The second one, just designate that as free space. Now, if you just want to play around with Linux, you don't really want to screw anything up at all, then don't do this at all. You can just boot up off the Fedora disk, and we'll catch you up later. Because there's Fedora will do a pretty good job of locating what free space there is. It'll probably maybe only be like 2 or 3 gigs, maybe 1.5 gig, but that would be enough, I guess, for it to install a basic system and kind of let you play around with it. Doing it this way, there's a lot of different ways with your two partitions. There are different methods, yet again, of what you're going to boot into. If you install Mac OS X first, on that first partition, then when you install Linux afterwards, it is going to put a little tiny, tiny little partition at the very front of your drive called a master boot record, and it's going to give you the option on a little text-based screen of what you want to boot into, whether you want to boot into Mac OS X, Linux, off of the CD, and off of the network, and so on. If you install Fedora first, and you can do that on the second partition, on that free space partition, and then go in and install Mac OS X second on that first Mac OS partition, then Mac gets to write that little tiny partition to the very front of the drive. And when you boot up, it will go straight into the Macintosh OS X. So by default, you'll be booting into OS X. And as we all know, the way to dual boot a machine ever since Mac OS X came out and people were booting into OS 9 and OS 10 alternately is simply to hold down the Option key. And this works if you do it this way. You can hold down the Option key and you'll get the hard drive on the left with a little Finder logo on by it, and you'll get a hard drive on the right with a little penguin by it, and you can choose which drive you want to boot into. So that's the very, very Mac way of doing it. So you need to you partition your drive, leaving basically both blank. One is simply an empty space allotted for a Mac system, and the other is an empty space allotted for empty space that Linux can then commandeer. But do the Linux first and then the Mac if you want the full Mac experience. Do the Mac first and the Linux second if you want the Linux experience. It actually matters which order you do it in, so make your choice wisely. So let's just assume we're going to do it Linux first and then Mac, so that we can just hold down the Option key to boot into Linux if we want to. To do that, simply because the other way is a no-brainer, you can just install your Mac OS X right now and then boot off the Linux drive and start that up. Or boot off the Linux installation disk and start that up. So this one, what you'll have to do is get out of the disk utility after you've repartitioned the drive. You've committed everything, it's erased everything. You get out of the disk utility and shut it down. It's not going to want to shut down. It's going to... Usually people don't go into disk utility, erase the drive, and then leave. Typically the workflow is you go in, you erase it, and then you install a system. Well, you're not going to be installing a system yet, so you'll have to maneuver it so that you can get out of doing that. And you can do that by telling it to quit the installer. Well, quit disk utilities first, and then I think you have to go to quit installer, and then it's going to want to ask you, it will ask you what you want to boot off of. I don't believe there's an option to simply shut down, so you may have to convince it to shut down by hitting the power key and holding it down until it shuts off. Or you can just hit restart and then hold down the mouse button so that the Mac OS X CD is ejected, and you can pop in the Linux installation disk after that. You may still have to reboot yet again simply to get it to recognize the installation drive, because right now it'll panic since it won't be able to find a system folder anywhere. It will give you the flashing folder with a question mark on it, not really sure what to do. It's got an empty hard drive in it. Not a problem. All you want to do, the end result should be to get the Linux installation disk in the drive and then start it up off of that Linux installation disk. you're having trouble booting up off of the installation disk, there are a couple of things that you can do. If it's an older Mac, you can try an older version of Linux. Hunt down something that isn't quite as recent as, for instance, Fedora 8, which just came out last month, or this month. Try finding a different distribution, like Debian. Like I say, Debian seems to be one of the most robust installers I've ever used, so if you want to try that, you certainly can. Ubuntu also has some lightweight distribution versions called Xubuntu, or Zubuntu, and that is based on Debian, and you could try that. That will treat your old Mac a lot better, and they do have a PowerPC version of that. Obviously, again, it's not the most recent version, so you'll have to look through their website a little bit, find an older version of it, and try that. You can also try just checking the installation disk itself. All of the Linux distribution disks that you'll download, and quite a number of software that you'll get for it, or extra packages for it that you'll get, come packaged along with something called an MD5 sum. This MD5 sum is a series of bits that, if anything has changed in the file that you've downloaded, the MD5 sum that comes along with that disk, or is that associated with that disk, will not be the same as the sum of what you've just downloaded. The way to verify that the disk is downloaded correctly is to look into the FTP or the HTTP mirror from which you are able to get the disk. Maybe you BitTorrented it, but you can still look at one of the FTP servers that hosts a copy of it. Usually, and they'll post an MD5 sum, just a little document called MD5 sum, usually, and it has that series of bits that your disk should give you if you do an MD5 sum on it. The way to do an MD5 sum is open up the terminal, type in MD5, that is M as in mini, D as in disk, and the number 5, spacebar, and then simply drag and drop that ISO that you downloaded onto the terminal at where your cursor is, and it'll pop that in. Or if you can type it in manually, you can do that too. Just type in the full path, obviously, of the disk image. And then hit enter. That will give you the string of numbers and letters and bits that you'll need to compare with a text file that you can find on the FTP server. If those two numbers match exactly, then the disk is fine. You probably just need to reburn it. If they're different, then something happened between you and while you were downloading it. Either some data was lost and just not assembled correctly, or someone changed the disk image after Fedora committed it. Someone, you know, whoever put it on BitTorrent changed it, and so you got an incorrect copy of it or something like that. You might have to go and just try downloading it from an FTP site. For the record, this has never happened to me. Every ISO that I've downloaded has come down fine and never gives me any problems. I'm just letting you know about this in case you do have a problem with it. You'll want to check that and then either re-download or reburn or whatever you think needs to happen. Assuming none of these problems are happening to you, then the first thing you'll see after you boot up off of the Fedora disk is, if I recall correctly, some things about language selection. So you'll want to simply select the primary language that you'll be using for your installation. Choose, I think, the region that you're in. And then you'll want to click through. I'm pretty sure the next screen is like their license agreement, or license information, rather, because there's not really much to agree to. After that, it might take you to like a network time panel where you'll need to choose what time zone you're in, things like that. Now, this is pretty self-explanatory, but at the very, very bottom of that screen, there is a checkbox that says System Time Uses UTC. Chances are you're going to need to check that off for your clock to be correct. You are not using UTC, probably. If you are, you would know it. So you'll want to check that off more than likely. Otherwise, you might get some weird dates and times entered into your clock. Now, the next screen is going to be about partitioning your drive, and this is the part where it gets a little bit fancy. For those of you just doing a clean install of Linux, you can just let them choose your... They'll do a custom configuration, and you can click through, and it's really a no-brainer. If you're doing the dual boot thing, there's a drop-down menu. Right now it says... It might say create custom layout, or delete all partitions. I'm not sure what the default is, but it will give you the option. There's a drop-down menu up at the top, and you can find use all free space and create Linux custom or create Linux partition. That's probably what you're going to want to do. Now, if you have a single hard drive, then you're finished. If you have literally a couple of different drives, you'll want to select which actual drive you're installing your Linux onto. But the way we're doing it here, at least, is we've partitioned a drive. So it's the same physical, real-world hard drive. It's that same actual device that they installed on the, in the computer. You know, the same thing that you can reach out and touch. It's the hard drive. That's the hard drive you'll want it to use. And there's not much to do about it. As long as you've set it to find the free space, it will locate that free space, and it will do all the rest of the hard work for you. Now, if you're doing this where you don't really necessarily have a whole lot of space on the hard drive, but you still want it to just use the free space that it can, you know, it may or may not have enough real free space to use. If not, you're going to have really no other choice. You know, if there's not enough free space for Linux to install itself into, you'll have to go back to OS X and partition the drive, which means erasing your entire hard drive. Either that, or probably the other easiest thing to do would be to get a Debian install disk, and that allows you to repartition your drive fairly easily without losing the data on one partition. But you really have to know what you're doing, and if you don't know what you're doing, don't attempt this. You will screw it up. The easiest way is, you know, if you're just trying to get a flavor, just try Linux, then I would probably just let it use whatever free space it does have available to it and go for it. So the exact options that you're going to have are remove all partitions on selected drives and create default layout. Remove Linux partitions on selected drives and create default layout. Use free space or selected on selected drives and create default layout, or create default layout. So for the people who are just doing something, they're just going to do nothing but Linux, then just remove all partitions on selected drive and create default layout. For people with a partitioned drive or with who just want to try out Linux and just want to have whatever free space exists become Linux, you can say use free space on selected drives and create default layout. Otherwise, you probably don't want to mess around with really anything else, unless you know what you're doing. After that, it's all a pretty self-explanatory process. You simply click through the menus that they give you, the options, choose, you know, whatever attributes you want to choose for your system, and it'll be pretty simple. At some point, it's going to ask you to create a root account to administer the system. Hey, this is the same deal as with OS X. The first account you create is going to have root privilege. Once again, you don't really want your to be like this sort of duplicitous user and root hybrid. You want to be root or user. So anytime I install either OS X or one of these sort of installation-friendly distributions like Fedora or Debian, you want to create your initial account, and then once you're finished installing, you're going to want to go back in and create a new user account. And you'll want to use that user, I think, for your everyday use, and simply sign on to that initial user that you created only when you need to really administer the system. probably good policy not to necessarily name that first user admin or root and give it the password admin or root. You'll probably want to make it something that makes sense to you, but maybe that wouldn't make sense to anyone else. And then the normal user can just be your name or your handle or whatever you go by on your computer. But that first user, reserve that for important stuff, and keep in mind that that's going to have access to root passwords that if someone, you know, if someone gets your user password, then they shouldn't also by default get your root password, right? So make these things distinct. After that, I think you get some menus about what exactly you want to install on your system. For instance, there's user and productivity options, there are programming options, just little things like that, just asking you basically what kind of software you want Fedora to go ahead and install for you. Typically, I choose the Office and Productivity and the software development. If you're not going to be doing any programming, then you don't need the software development. But if you're going to do programming, or if you're in school for programming, then go ahead and get the software development. It's got a lot of handy things like the Glade environment and, you know, the most up-to-date Python and stuff like that. And then there's web server. So unless you're going to be turning this into a web server, you probably don't need to install all that stuff. You click continue, and at some point you're going to be asked about something called SE Linux. SE Linux, I don't remember what it stands for, but it's essentially a security protocol or a security managing system. It helps you and it helps your system manage anything that comes into it that is suspicious. It kind of notifies you of this. It was developed, I think, by some government organization, and since Linux is under the GNU public license, which requires anyone who writes code for the system to give that code back to the community, they were required to do that, and so everyone benefited from all of their hard work, which is the idea behind the whole GPL philosophy. So it's a really good system. The default is typically what I leave on because I figure they probably know more about this stuff than I do. I leave it on the default setting, which is what they recommend. And you can certainly play around with that if you're just playing around or if you really, really understand security and system administration, stuff like that. The other option is going to be the actual firewall. And typically the only thing that I enable for this is SSH, which will allow me to log into my computer remotely via SSH. But there's no real reason to turn on anything else. This is the kind of incoming stuff that you're... I mean, the firewall outgoing, you've got access to everything. But incoming, I really only permit SSH. There's no reason to allow HTTP if I'm not going to be running a website off of the computer. No reason to enable things like Telnet. So SSH, or no reason for FTP either. So SSH is what I do. It seems to work pretty well for me. I leave everything else shut off. After all of that, you click install, and it will take a little while because it needs to install the entire system and lots of software. Unlike macOS 10, which is installing, the system and I think not much else, this might take a little bit longer because you're actually getting, for instance, an Office suite. You're getting GIMP. You're getting FSpot Photo Manager. You're getting sound and video players. And you're getting, depending on what you've chose as your install options, you may or may not be getting programming environments and things like that. So it might take a little bit longer than what you might expect, but it's good at showing you the progress that it's making. And sit back and let it install.
Full-bodied, refreshing hot coffee makes any time a pleasant interlude.
once Fedora has installed in your system, it will prompt you to reboot. You can reboot, and by default, it will have a little boot manager called Yaboot at the very beginning of your hard drive. So when you start up, it'll default to a little text screen that asks you if you want to boot into OS X, which right now you probably don't have on any drive, or into Linux, or off the CD drive, and so on. So now if you're ready to install OS X, you can do that at this point. Put in your OS X installation disk, boot off the CD, install OS X on that first partition. And from then on, you won't see this little Yaboot boot manager. You will instead just boot right into OS X by default, unless you hold down the Option key at boot time, in which case you will see an OS X drive and a Linux drive, and you can choose between those two, just as you would choose between, for instance, OS 9 and OS 10 back when OS 10 first came out, or if for whatever reason you're dual booting into Windows and Mac on your current Mac, just like you would do that. It'd be much better to be dual booting into Linux than into Windows. Or maybe you're just booting straight into Linux and you're not going to do the whole OS 10 thing. That's fine too, but then you'll see the Yaboot menu every time. There's a timeout set, you know, so that if you walk away, it doesn't just sit there without ever booting into your system. But it will eventually boot into Linux unless you tell it otherwise. Now, if you install OS X at this point, it's going to overwrite the Yaboot. You'll have your normal Apple boot manager. I'm going to skip over that because I think that's pretty self-explanatory. Boot off your OS X drive, do an installation as normal, and simply select that first partition as your as the thing to install onto. Now, you have three options when you're installing OS X. That is, do you want to erase and install, do you want to archive and install, or do you just want to install? I think the best choice here would just be to install. I'm pretty sure I've tried erasing and installing, and it doesn't repartition the drive. You know, it erases that partition that it sees as erasable. So it would still preserve your Linux partition, but since you've probably erased everything and repartitioned it anyway, you might as well just install, because there's nothing there to erase. So you'll be good to go if you just install. But it's fairly foolproof. You'll find that it works quite well. But since that is fairly foolproof and pretty self-explanatory in my opinion, we will just skip right over into booting into Linux. So once you're in Linux, you will find that Fedora has a nice little a login screen, and the login screen will ask you for your name and your password, so you can type in that initial name and that initial password that you created when you first when you were installing. So again, that's the root user of this machine, or rather it's the administrative user of that machine, not something I necessarily use every day myself. I'll show you how to create a new user in a minute. So once you're on Fedora, you'll see that it's fairly familiar. It's got a bar at the top, a menu bar at the top. It's got a little bar at the bottom for your different desktops, kind of like a dock. And it's pretty self-explanatory. There's the computer icon, there's your home folder, and there's a trash. Now, right now, you're probably not going to have internet. You're not going to have wireless connectivity. For that, we need to basically break your airport card and then fix it again. And we're going to do that in a little while. But first, we'll just take a little tour of the desktop. The application menu on the upper left corner contains, well, all of your applications. And you can kind of scroll through the different folders in the applications and get a feel for what they've installed. There's accessories with things like a calculator and a dictionary and a screenshot tool and just your basic text editor. There's games, which are just kind of basic little, you know, computer desktop games, including probably most importantly a Tetris style game. There are graphics. So here you have your F-Spot Photo Manager, which is like iPhoto. You've got your GNU Image Manipulation Program, which of course is Photoshop and so much more. There's GThumb Image Viewer, which is kind of like Preview. And there's a scanner tool, so that if you're going to be scanning things in from a flatbed, you can use that. Internet, you've got your contacts, so that's your address book. You've got email, you've got Firefox, you've got Internet Messenger, which is called Pigeon. It's kind of like, well, it's iChat, basically. There's IP telephony, so for like Skype and things like that, or SIP or Gizmo. And there's a BitTorrent client, which is such a great thing about Linux. You know, on Mac OS X, the last thing you're going to see installed by default is BitTorrent client. There's Office, which has your calendar, your presentation, which would be like Keynote or PowerPoint. Project management, so if you're into like Entourage, you can sort of do that there. Spreadsheet, tasks, word processor, you know, all the typical Office stuff. I have a programming menu, which contains the Glade Interface Designer, which is kind of nice. Sound and video for all your CD playing and movie playing, your volume controls, Rhythmbox Music Player, which is kind of like iTunes, except it's not as terrible as iTunes. Sound Juicer, so that's to rip CDs. And then there's System Tools, which contains, probably most importantly, your terminal. There's a system monitor in there. There's the SE Linux management for the security stuff. Things like that. Notice also that there's a file browser. A file browser is essentially your file manager. So that's the Finder. Like if you had said New Finder Window, it would bring up a window with all your files in it. Well, this is your file browser. That's how you get there. You don't need to go into the Applications menu to get there. Obviously, you can just double-click on your computer icon on your desktop, and it'll take you there as well, or your home folder there on the desktop. But just be aware that that's your file browser. That's your Finder. And then there's Add and Remove Software at the very bottom of the list of the Applications folder. This is Fink Project, except it's Fedora. But that's where you go for all the software that you want to install. You don't go to a store to buy the software like you would for Mac OS X. You simply go to the Add Remove Software, you find the software that you want, you click Install, and it installs it. It's very, very nice, very easy. The Places menu, so that's one over from the Applications. Places would be like the Go menu, which you probably never used on OS X anyway, but it is it's where you go to quickly access a certain folder. You can click on the home folder to go to your home, you can go to the computer, you can browse your network, you can search for certain files, there's recent documents. If you had an external hard drive plugged in, right now I've got a USB thumb drive plugged in, so that appears both on the desktop and in the Places menu. One over is System. So System is like the Apple menu, sort of. There's the Preferences menu, or there's the Preferences group, which has, you know, all the configuration for the system, like the appearance, hardware information, what it detects on your system, power management, like when your computer's going to sleep, things like that. And then there's the Administration group, which has date and time, the display settings, so if your resolution needs to be set differently, you can go there. Firewall settings, keyboard settings, so you can customize keyboard shortcuts and how your keyboard behaves, printing setup, sound card detection, and then there's the users and groups. So that's important. We'll get back to that in a minute. You can also see in your system drop-down menu, there's your help. There's about GNOME. GNOME is it's really what you're looking at. It's the graphic interface on this particular distribution of Linux. And then there's the lock your screen, which is handy if you walk away from your computer. You don't want people coming up behind you and typing over your work. There's log out, which we'll do after we set up a new user. And then there's the shutdown, which self-explanatory. Further over on the right side of the screen, of course, you've got an indication showing you that you're running on battery power or AC power. Right now I'm plugged in. You've got the name of your user, so that's my administrative user right now. It's the only one, but that's when we want to switch. We can switch between, you know, the two users there if we want to. You've got your date and time, And you've got your little volume control. So it's very much, in a way, you know, very much like OS X. I mean, the basic concept is the same. Now, down at the bottom, you've got your dock, or you've got your, I don't know what they call it in Linux. I think maybe your kicker or something like that. On the very left-hand corner, there's a little image of a sort of a desktop. That is akin to hitting, what is it, F11 in Mac OS X, where you swipe every... throw everything off your desktop really quickly so you can see your actual desktop. So if you've got a lot of applications open, you can click that and it'll show you your desktop. And then when you click it again, everything comes back to where it was. And then there's a big blank area, which will, of course, house applications and documents as you're running them. And then on the very right-hand side, there are four little squares. Now, these are your virtual desktops. Leopard users will now recognize that. Before Leopard, OS X had no equal. And this is a very handy device, and I find it works really smoothly in Linux. You can switch between different desktops so that if you're surfing the web on one screen and you want to switch over to a PDF document, and then you want to switch over to your chatting program, and then you want to switch over to something else. You know, you've got four desktops here that you can configure and set up. And you can add more if you want, but I find four is usually sufficient for me. And then very, very on the right corner, there's your little trash icon. So it's going to be where you go to look at what you've got in your trash, and if you double-click, you'll see that it opens up, and you'll have a button to empty the trash. So if you had anything in there, you could then delete it from your computer. So right now, we're going to go back up to the system menu up at the top, go over to administration, go into user and groups. Now, right away, it's asking you to enter your password, and notice that it clearly says that it's authenticating you as root, and this is why we don't use this initial user as our primary user. If anyone finds out your user password, then they automatically know your administration password. Not a good idea. So once the user manager pops up, you'll see that it's again, fairly self-explanatory. There's an add user, add group, refresh, and help buttons. I'm just going to go ahead and click on add user, and you can create a new user right there. You can give yourself a nice username, full name, password, everything like that. And from that, it will generate a new home folder for you and give you your little environment that you'll be able to customize, and you'll be a nice non-administration user, so that if anyone does get your user password, they still don't have your administration password. Very nice. Now, once you've done that, you can go up to System and log out. You'll be taken back to your login screen. You can log back in as your normal user and continue using your new Linux system. Now, traditionally, one of the hardest things to get working on Linux when you're installing it onto, almost any computer, really, but especially Apple-manufactured computers, is the wireless card. Simply because the wireless companies, a lot of them seem to have some problem disclosing how the cards work, so Linux programmers can't write drivers for the cards. Now, of course, these companies could, if they cared, they could just write Linux drivers themselves. For whatever reason, they don't bother. And so it's very difficult sometimes to get a wireless card to work on Linux. It's notoriously difficult. Well, good news is that certain programmers are so determined that they've actually come up with ways to sort of reverse engineer the cards and come up with ways to get them working in Linux. Now, from what I'd understood for a very long time, the Airport Extreme card was very difficult. And it was one of the reasons that for a very long time I didn't have Linux installed on my Mac, especially my portable, simply because I didn't expect to get wireless working. So I installed it on a PC laptop as the only OS on there, and it had an Intel wireless card. It had all Intel chips, Intel interior parts were all Intel, so they all had drivers for Linux already written by Intel. So it was really easy. But the Airport Extreme card is supposed to be pretty hard. But luckily, there's been quite a bit of progress made on the Broadcom chips, and now, as long as you follow instructions carefully, you should be able to get your Airport card to work, Airport Extreme card, to work pretty well, and in fact flawlessly, quite well. So the Airport Extreme cards use a Broadcom chip. There's a Broadcom 4300 series chipset, and the Airport cards that use that can very easily be made to work under Linux. Now, I think there might have been a certain amount of Airport Extreme cards made with some other chipset, which is a pity, and it's just kind of like, you can kind of get a feel for the problem that Linux programmers have. I mean, even when the exterior of the card looks the same and says the same thing, the interior is using something completely different. So, the first thing that you have to do is, and I should preface all of this with, if you do this, you're not going to lose functionality of the Airport card under OS X. You're not doing anything drastic like flashing new firmware onto it or anything like that. You're stealing some stuff from the Airport card, but you're not doing anything that's going to render it useless if you mess it up. The worst case scenario will be that it just won't work under Linux, and you'll have to try again. But there's no chance of you screwing up your card or anything like that. So what you have to do is, first of all, confirm that you have the precise firmware in the Airport card that you think you have. And this is easiest to do in Linux. So if you're in your Linux partition, you would simply open up a terminal and type in lspci. That's all one word, and it's ls, as in list, pci, as in a PCI slot. So lspci, and then the pipe symbol. Remember that the pipe symbol is the key right above the return key, right under the delete key. There's that long, straight line. That's the pipe symbol. So it's lspci, space, pipe, space, grep. That's G-R-E-P. G-R-E-P, space, dash I, space, Broadcom. That's Broadcom. So you should you should see a return of something talking about a network controller, Broadcom Corporation, BCM, something, something, something. So my exact return was 0001:10:12.0, network controller, Broadcom Corporation, BCM 4306, 802.11, B/G, wireless LAN controller, Rev03. Now, if you've got that one, you're going to be really happy, because this is all going to work exactly as expected. And from what I understand, there's a whole series of 4300 numbers that are really easy to do this with. The revision 03 is really easy. So if you've got that, you're kind of made in the shade. If you don't have that exact return information on the LSPCI, you might have some more trouble. Either way, I'm going to include some links on in the show notes about the websites that helped me out initially, the most of all. And next week we'll be talking a lot about IRC channels as well, and those are always great places for help. So now that we've established what card we have, so we've got the Broadcom chipset, and we've got we know the exact kind of firmware that we have. And I don't know about the legalities of any of this. I'm really not sure, but the point is that the way to do this is that you can go to a site called berlioz.de. That's berlioz.de. And they've got all the software that you're going to need. Now, to make things a little bit more complicated, there are two versions of the software that you might need. To be safe, we're going to do both. So we'll grab both, and the specific names of the software, well, you'll see it on their site, but and certainly I'll include links to this on the show notes. But the specific names are BCM43XX-FW-Cutter-006, and there is also the B43-FW-Cutter-008. So these are the two software packages that you'll need to download, which will enable you, it's going to cut out the firmware that you need from the airport card and let the Linux partition borrow that firmware. It's quite clever. So first you'll have to download that, and that's going to download to wherever you happen to set it to download. You'll probably be doing this through Firefox, so when you click to download it, it should ask you where to download it. I just go ahead and put it on my desktop because I'm going to use it and then ditch it. So download that. Once it's downloaded, you'll need to extract the files. So you know how in Mac OS X you've got .zip files, and then in OS 9 we had the stuffit files, .sit, things like that. Well, in Linux we have .tar, .tar, .bz2, .tar, .gz, a couple of different ways to archive things, and then different ways on top of that to compress things. So we'll probably go into that later, because it's kind of an art to it and a technique to it that you'll need to get down to exist in Linux happily. But the idea right now is to extract these files. So we're going to type into the terminal. We'll make sure that you're in the desktop first in the terminal. So obviously CD desktop. And then you're going to type in TAR, that's tar, space, dash, JXF. That is J as in Jolly, X, F as in Frank, space, BCM43XX-FW-Cutter-006-.tar.bz2, so obviously the file name, and then hit return, and that will extract it and plop out a normal-looking folder onto your desktop. And then you'll do the same thing for that B43FW-Cutter-008, so it would be tar, space, dash JXF space B43-FW-Cutter-008.tar.bz2. So once that's been done, you're going to have to compile the program. Now I know that that sounds really intense, and actually it is, but it just works really well. There are other things that sometimes don't compile as nicely, and it kind of becomes an art and a technique, but compiling from source code is not actually as hard as you'd think. Sometimes. So first we'll have to change directories from the desktop into the actual folder that contains the program. So, and we'll need to do it twice. Remember, everything we're doing twice because we just need to make sure that we get exactly what we need for the card, and it's really hard to tell what that card needs. So if we just do it twice, we'll be covering our backs really well, and we'll have a greater chance of success. So to compile this, first we'll cd space bcm43xx-fwcutter-006. So now we're in that folder. And then we're going to type make. And it's that simple. It'll start compiling. It's a pretty quick compile. It must be a very small software. So it will result in some feedback code telling you that everything, you know, worked well. If you see the word error or failure, you've done something wrong, but I did this long before I'd really compiled anything before, and it worked perfectly for me. So if you're doing well, you're going to have a little program called BCM43XX-FW-Cutter, and it won't look, it doesn't have a fancy icon or anything like that, so you just have to look for something called BCM43XX-FW-Cutter, and that is the program that you're going to be using. Now you have to do the same thing in the other folder. So now you're going to cd dot dot slash bcm, no, b43-fwcutter-008. So however you want to get into that folder, you can do it. I would just cd space dash dash slash b43-fwcutter-008. But you could also cd out under your desktop and then cd back into that folder if you don't quite have the navigation of the folders yet. So once you're in that folder in the terminal, type in make, and it will make that program. So it'll compile that for you. So then that will end up with a little program called b43-fwcutter. And that's the program that you'll also use. So you're going to go steal some code now. So we're going to go into Broadcom, we're going to steal some code, take it back to our Linux partition. So to do this, we have to mount the Mac OS partition that we've got. We need to mount it into our Linux file system. Now, if you don't have a Mac OS partition, if you just decided that this was going to be a Linux book and that's it, that's fine, but you're going to have to go to some place that has a Mac OS partition and do some variation of this. Again, I'm going to include lots of links in the show notes so that you can kind of find out some of the exceptional ways that you might have to do this. But it just depends on how you're setting up your system. So if you've got the Linux partition and the Mac partition, the way you're going to mount it is, first of all, you'll have to cd space slash mnt. Okay, so in Linux, when you mount something, especially when you're doing it manually, there's a place for it in your file system as if though it was just another file or a folder, kind of like an iDisk. This place is slash mnt. Now in slash mnt, you can make folders that will then represent the whatever you're mounting. So if it's a USB drive, you could mount the USB drive so that all of its contents basically appear in that folder, or an external hard drive, or in this case, another partition. So you'll cd space slash mnt, and then you're going to type in mkdir, as in make directory, mkdir space macOS, macOS. You can call it whatever you like. I think it makes sense, though, to call it macOS, because that's very clearly what it's going to represent. So now, we need to know the device name of the Mac OS X partition, and that is not always easy to find out. Remember I told you to take note of the HDA number when you were first partitioning? Okay, that's where this would come into play. So if you remember that there was a big, fat partition allotted for your Mac OS X OS, the number on that particular, the fattest partition, it would be HDA, 2, or HDA 3, or HDA 5, something. That's the number, that's the device name of where your Mac OS partition is located. If you can't remember that, or if you couldn't figure it out, it's honestly not that hard to figure out. You can simply, there's only a couple of things that it would realistically be. Anywhere from HDA 1 up to maybe HDA 9, probably. So I would just type in the terminal, mount, mount, space, slash, dev, slash, HDA 1, space, slash, mnt, slash, Mac OS. What's that? That's telling the computer that you want to mount something that's located on slash dev slash HDA 1 onto a place on your file system called slash mnt slash Mac OS. Now if that doesn't work, just type in it again, except instead of HDA 1, do HDA 2. If that doesn't work, try HDA 3. Now it might not tell you that it doesn't work. So you might have to change directory into the mount, the /mnt/macOS, and just look around, do an ls, and see what's in there. If it's empty, that means nothing got mounted to it, and so you'll need to try mounting it again. Once you've tried it, list again, and if there's nothing in there, all right, it didn't mount, try it again. So you just kind of keep doing that. I think that's what I did at some point, and eventually on the third try, so it was HDA3 for me, when I did an ls, suddenly there was stuff in the mount, the /mnt/macOS folder. It was obviously Mac stuff because there was the mock kernel, there was the, you know, volume folder, which doesn't exist in Linux, it exists on the macOS. So there was obviously something being mounted there. I looked around a little bit more into the users folder. I saw the users that I had set up, so I knew that I had mounted it successfully. Alright, so now that we've got our macOS mounted, we need to change directory again back into, for instance, the, let's do the B43 first. So you'll change directory back to your desktop folder, and then you'll change directory again back into the B43-FWCutter-008. So as long as you're there, you can type in exactly this. /B43-FWCutter/lib/firmware/space/mnt/macOS/system/Apple/library/l/extensions/Apple/AirPort2.kext. And the A in Apple, the A in Air, and the P in Port are all capitalized. So it's AppleAirPort2.kext/contents/macOS, it's a capital M and a capital O and a capital S, /AppleAirPort2. Again, capital A, capital A, capital P. And the number 2. So that is exactly what you need to type in. It's a very long, convoluted command. But basically what we're doing is we're going into the macOS system, the system library and extensions, in the AppleAirPort2.kext, which is a kernel extension, into the contents, into the macOS, and taking out the AppleAirPort2 firmware. And then we're copying it to our Linux lib/firmware. So I'm going to say all that again, basically, because we're going to do it again for the BCM43XX. So it should kick in on the second time. So once you've done that, you'll get some files in your /lib/firmware. We'll double check on that in a minute. So once you've done that, then you're going to change directory again back into your BCM43XX-FWCutter-006 folder. And you're going to type in this, /BCM43XX-FWCutter/lib/firmware, all lowercase, /mnt/macOS/system/Apple/library/l/extensions/Apple/AirPort2.kext, and again that's capital A, capital A, capital P, /contents/macOS/MacOS/Apple AirPort 2, and then hit return. You're going to again see a little bit of feedback, I believe, a little bit of code telling you that it's done what you've requested. if I recall correctly. And then you're going to go ahead and change directories, cd space slash lib slash firmware, and do a list, an ls, there in firmware. And you should see that there are some new files there with names relating to things like B43, B43 Legacy, and a whole series of files starting with BCM43XX. As long as you see those, chances are you've done everything perfectly, and it's probably going to work already. But just to make sure, there's one more thing that we can do, which is to download some drivers, just in case they're not in our kernel already. Now, I'm pretty sure that in Fedora 8, the drivers for this are already installed. I could be wrong about that. Either way, if you're not doing Fedora 8, or even if you are, it doesn't hurt to install these drivers. So we're going to go ahead and do it. So the drivers that we're going to download are located at openwrt.org, which is a site dedicated to wireless, getting wireless to work under Linux without the support of the companies that we're trying to use their equipment. So the exact link to the first one is downloads.openwrt.org/sources/broadcom-wl-4.80.53.0.tar.bz2. The other one is downloads.openwrt.org/sources/wl_apsta-3.130.20.0. And that is an O, not a zero. I will either include links to those in the show notes, or I'll just include the actual packages themselves. I have to see if I'm allowed to redistribute them. So you'll need to untar these, that is, extract them, and you'll want to place the document that results from extracting it into both the B43-FW-Cutter-008 folder and the BCM43XX-FW-Cutter-006 folder. So here's what you'll need to do. Again, it's tar space dash jxf space broadcom dash wl dash 4.80.53.0.tar.bz2. That will untar that one. I haven't done this recently enough to remember what you need to do to that other one. It doesn't, by the name of the file, it doesn't appear to be tarred at all, so you may have to do nothing. But either way, you'll be able to extract it somehow, one way or another. Fedora makes it pretty easy to extract as well. You don't have to do it within the terminal either. So then you're going to want to place a file called wl_apsta-3.130.20.0.0. That's that second document that you downloaded. You're going to want to place a copy of that in both folders, the B43-FW-Cutter-008 and the BCM43-XX-FW-Cutter-006 folders. So just copy it into those two folders. You're going to want to place a document called WL_APSTA.O in the B43-FW-Cutter-008 folder only. So do that. And then as root, you need to be root to do this. So in the terminal, just become root. So that would be su, and then enter your root password, your name and your password. For the BCM43XX, we're going to do this. Just type in BCM43XX-FW-Cutter space dash W space slash lib slash firmware space WL_APSTA-3.130.20.0. So that's easy. Now you're going to do the B43 legacy. and that's very, very similar. It is. You're going to type in. You'll have to change. You have to change into the B43 folder for this one. B43-FWCutter space dash W space /lib/firmware/ WL underscore APSTA dash 3.130.20.0.0. So it's very similar to the other one, it's just in the B43 folder. And for that other one, you should have been in the BCM43XX folder. Forgot to mention that. Hopefully you're kind of getting a feel for what we're doing, though. We're taking the things that we've put in folders and distributing them out into our file system. Now, this is in the same folder. This is in the B43 folder still. So you're going to type in B43-FWCutter space dash W space /lib/firmware/ WL underscore APSTA dot O. And that's it. You're done. So it's a lot of steps, but it's actually pretty quick. And it's pretty easy after you kind of get a feel for what you're doing. You're downloading the files, you're unstuffing them, you're extracting them, you're untarring them. You're going into the folders, you're compiling the software, and then you're doing something from within that folder. You're running that little program in that folder and affecting it out into your file system. That's basically what you're doing. There's a little bit of a detour there where we had to go into the macOS partition and grab out that firmware, but don't be fooled by that. The rest of it's pretty simple. As long as you're making sure you're in the right folder when you're typing in the correct commands, you should be fine. Now, after you're done all of that, you're really ready to go. You might have to reboot. I think I had to reboot. I'm pretty sure I had to reboot after that to get it working. Once you've rebooted, whether you realize it or not, you're online, you're ready to be online. Now, there's a couple of things that you should always make sure that you're going to do when you're testing out your wireless connection. Number one is get rid of any password off of your router. So take all your computers offline that are at all important to you. Take your router and configure it to have no password protection. So right now, you've got an open port. Anyone in the world, well, not anyone in the world, anyone on in your apartment building could get online via your router because you don't have a password, even a wet password. You just don't have a password. And you're only going to need it that way for a couple of minutes while you test to see if you can get on your router at all. Now, if not, then at least you know it's not the router's problem. If you can get on, then at least you know that everything's working, and then you can start password encrypting everything, and any stumbling blocks along the way, you know it's not with the router and it's not with a card. So, after you've disabled the password on your router, you're going to want to make sure that the network manager in Fedora is turned on. For some reason, in Fedora 8, when I first installed it, the network manager was not turned on. And I don't know why that would be the default, but it just wasn't there. And it turned out to be a really, really easy fix. It's just literally something you have to know to go and do if it's not on all the time. And the way to do that is you go up to the system menu up at the top left of the Fedora screen, go down to administration, and then go over to services and turn on the two NM underscore applet services that are listed there. It will probably make you into your root password to do that, which is fine. And then you're going to want to just make sure that you see a little sort of a wireless connection applet appear up on the right-hand corner of the screen. It's similar to the functionality. It's actually the same functionality of that AirPort pie slice that's up in the right-hand corner of your macOS partition. The little radar signal, you know, that tells you how strong of a signal you have, whether you're online, whether you're not online. So the NM underscore applet, that will tell you if you're online right now, and it lets you choose which wireless connection or which wireless network you want to join. So once that's turned on, go over there to the right, click on the, I think it's two computers by default. It shows two little computers with a red X if it's not turned on, if it's not online. You'll want to click on that, find your network, whatever your router's network name is, and select that. And like I say, you should be able to sign on really quickly because there's no password there, and it should just work. In my experience, it has just worked. It hasn't been a problem at all. Now, if there is a problem, like I say, it's not your router, so it must be your card. And in that case, you're going to need to do a lot of troubleshooting. Now, there's a lot of different ways to troubleshoot. There are a lot of possible problems here. But the first thing that you'll probably want to do is go to the terminal, become root, and type in /sbin/iwconfig. So look at the iwconfig. This is very similar to ifconfig on Linux and Mac or BSD. Ifconfig tells you what kind of network interfaces you've got configured on the machine. iwconfig tells you what kind of wireless network connectors you've got configured. So if you see something called WLAN0, that's a good thing. That means that the Linux system is actually recognizing that you have a wireless card in the computer, meaning that you've done the drivers and everything right. It's just that you're not somehow connecting to the networks. So that's a good sign. If you don't see anything WLAN0, look for something else. On Fedora, it's called WLAN0. On other systems, I've seen them be called something else, like ETH0 or ETH1. On Mac, it's typically called EN0, EN1. So, you know, kind of look around and see what you see. Anything called LO, that's nothing. That'll do you no good. But if you see something, I believe in Fedora that ETH1 is reserved for an actual Ethernet port. So I think you're looking for something more like WLAN0 or something like that. So if you see that, you're actually, you know, the computer's seeing your card, you're just not doing something right in terms of getting online. Now you can also, just to make sure that it's actually being recognized and that's all being loaded in, type in DMESG space pipe space grep GREP space BCM. And that will show you anything that while it was booting up, anything that it was talking to the kernel about BCM, which is obviously your Broadcom chip, your airport express card. So if you don't see anything in there listed as BCM, that could be a problem. Or if you're not seeing anything listed as B43, you can also do DMESG space pipe space grep space B43. If you don't see anything there, then that could be a problem. You can obviously do something called LSMod. You'll definitely need to get familiar with this. LSMod is a great tool because it lists all the modules that have been loaded into the kernel at boot time. Now, modules, you might be able to think of it as extensions back in OS 9. When you would boot into OS 9, it would load up all those extensions, and a lot of times the first thing you would do when you were having problems is you'd reboot holding the shift key down so that it didn't load any of those extensions. You might remember those days. So this is very similar. So an LSMod will list all the modules that were loaded up during boot, and if you see that there are things, you know, with BCM in it or B43, then you're definitely, that card is alive. It's just you're not getting online for some reason. I would again check the router, make sure that you've got the passwords off, make sure that it is functioning. You know, try it on one of your computers that does work. Make sure you can connect to the router on a working computer, and continue then trying with the Linux computer. So you might have to do it all manually. You shouldn't have to, but there are ways to bring the card onto the network just manually, and the way to do that is iwconfig space WLAN0 space ESSID space and then the name of your network. So the iwconfig, again, is the same tool that we were just using earlier. The WLAN 0, I'm saying because that's what it was called on my computer. Again, for some reason, if you're not doing Fedora, maybe it'll be named something else. You could try, try the interface that seems to be alive for you. Again, it might be EN1 or EN0 or ETH0 or something like that. So give a couple of different tries. ESSID is just the networking term for a network name. So the name of your router might be called, MyRouter or Netgear or Linksys. Hopefully you don't really use those names, but whatever the name might be, it's saying that you're now going to tell it what the name is. So it's ESSID space and then the name of your network. So remember that you can't use spaces in the terminal. You'll have to use the forwards, the backslash and a space. Make sure that you've got a sensible name for the router. You can kind of play around with that if it's not working. And then once you're on the network, you'll want to scan the network. So do a slash sbin slash iwlist space wlan 0 space scan. Now that's going to tell you a lot of data about the surrounding wireless environment. So everything that's in range, like all your neighbors' routers, they'll come up. The signal-to-noise ratio of those. Lots and lots of information about the environment around you. This is a very handy tool in general, but this is going to be telling you information about your network, more importantly. Now, if you get that information, you're definitely working. The card is definitely working, and the problem is not with the computer, it's with your router. So just take a look at the information it gives you about your network. Make sure that it's not strange. Maybe reboot your router, something like that. But it should work if you're getting all that. But those are some troubleshooting tools. Primarily, I really think it's going to work pretty quickly. I don't think you're going to have too much of a problem with it. It really is a pretty simple thing. You might have to listen to this segment a couple of times to get all the commands. But I'll try to also have as many links as possible in the show notes. Have a running and really cool Fedora system now, and depending on how old the computer is that you're trying this out with, your experience with it may or may not be, as snazzy as the latest and greatest Mac running Leopard, for instance. You have to keep in mind that even though Linux is a very flexible operating system, it can only do so much with whatever you're giving it. So if you're trying it on an iBook G4, for instance, don't expect to be able to turn on all the cool eye candy that, someone with it running on a very recent PC or a very recent MacBook or MacBook Pro could have on. Obviously, you're still restrained by what the system has in it. iBook G4s, iBook G3s, don't really have that great of a graphic card, or rather they have integrated graphic systems, so they're not going to be able to handle that much. If you're running it on something with, say, 256 megabytes of RAM, don't expect it to be blazingly fast either. Although, keep in mind that at least you could install it on that computer and actually use it comfortably, whereas Leopard won't even install with 256 megs. I think it requires something like 512. So the idea of it being flexible is great, but you have to be realistic as well as in terms of what you're expecting from it. I initially installed my Fedora OS on an iMac G4 that was or an iBook G4 that was running Tiger, and Fedora ran quite well with the 256 megs of RAM allotted to it, but I have recently upgraded it to a full gig of RAM, and it's working really, really well, and is running quite fast. I'm very, very pleased with it. Not necessarily a marked improvement over Tiger's performance, but certainly on the same level, and I no longer have the vast amounts of codec problems and video-related problems that I was having before, so I'm quite happy with it, very impressed with it. Keep in mind, too, that the Linux OS is designed and implemented and programmed by people who are largely not getting paid to work on it. They are people who simply like to program and do this stuff in their spare time. It's very incredible. The same applies for all the support that comes along with, or a lot of the support that comes along with Linux. While you can pay for support contracts by different companies, you also can find a lot of support online for things that you might want to get done at linuxquestions.org. And I'll definitely include that in the show notes. Linuxquestions.org is a forum. You can register for free. It's not a terribly painful process to register. You can you can sign into the forum room that concerns the particular Linux distribution you've picked. Now, if you're running it on a Mac, you're a little bit in the minority. A lot of the Linux world runs their stuff on a PC, Intel-based kind of situation. So you might be a little bit unique if you're doing a PowerPC thing, but the Linux OS itself is still the same, so usually most of your questions won't be anything that people can't deal with, especially the more seasoned Linux users. So if you have any questions, post there. You know, be as detailed as you can. Remind everyone that you're a newbie so that they don't give you instructions that are way over your head, and I think you'll do all right. So, once again for the road, what's the big deal about Linux, and why would we want to install it on a Mac, right? Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, Linux is a Unix-like operating system, so it's really, really smooth running and robust, and it's just really cool to play around with. There's nothing, I think, more fun than sitting down at a Linux computer and just diving into either the programs that they are offering, or just getting into the terminal and looking around the system and learning about where everything is kept and how remarkably easy it is to configure things. Once you learn where things are located, you can do the configuration fairly easily, because you just know that all you have to do is open up a text file and put in the different file paths or the options that you want. And suddenly the system reflects that change. It's such a smooth and easy way to make changes, and you really start to understand what's going on under the hood. Another really important aspect of Linux is the software freedom aspect of it. And a lot of people don't really understand what other people mean when they talk about software freedom. And it is kind of an abstract concept in certain ways, and while most of the software that you're going to find for Linux does happen to be free, monetarily speaking, that is, you don't pay for it, or you don't have to pay for it. You certainly can make donations to the programmer, but even more importantly is that the software is not hindered in any way by copyrights or trade secrets or any kind of, you know, competitive edge that sometimes actually hinders a software more than it helps a software. For instance, one of my favorite things to harp on is about how, for instance, Final Cut Pro, which is an exceedingly expensive software package, simply has certain limitations to it that don't really need to be limitations. They're more like they're broken by design, because Final Cut Pro is competing with, for instance, another company which owns a certain format of video, And so Final Cut Pro won't include support for that format of video, because to do so would appear to be supporting their competing video company. This is why you couldn't, for instance, bring in an XVID or certain forms of MPEGs or a Windows Media file into Final Cut and just start editing it. You often have to transcode it or convert it, and so you're losing quality right from the start, and that's just not a great thing. And on a software that is that expensive, you'd expect to be able to pretty much be able to throw anything into it and have it start editing it. There shouldn't really be any question about that. Another one of my favorite examples is Photoshop. Photoshop will open lots of different files, but it can't seem to handle, for instance, a .xcf or a .svg or a there was some other extension that I came across just the other day that Photoshop simply wouldn't open. In fact, no package in the entire Adobe suite would open it, even Illustrator, Flash, all that stuff, which just shocked me because it was a package of clip art that was being sold, you know, in the stores. It seemed legitimate enough by corporate standards, but nevertheless, it wouldn't open it. Now, Photoshop, if you've looked at the price lately, is at least $700 if you're just getting that alone, and it goes up to $2,500 if you're getting the full suite. So there's a certain expectation with $2,500, and for it not to open files that, for instance, NeoOffice would open in its little drawing package was kind of shocking. So there's a certain competition and a certain broken by design aspect to the commercial software. There is also the aspect of expectation and support. Now, if a software package, regardless of cost, claims that it will do a certain set of things, it is your expectation as the consumer to have it do those certain things. If it doesn't, if something goes wrong, what recourse do you as a consumer have? Typically, unless it's within the first 30 or 90 days, you really have no recourse at all. Maybe in the first 30 or 90 days you can call their support line, which may or may not actually exist, talk to someone about the problem you're having, and maybe they'll be able to help you figure it out. Quite likely they won't, because there's just so many variables with these kinds of software packages and the different kinds of system that people are running it on, the different kind of thing that people are doing on the software. And aside from that, they're not really getting paid to help you solve your problem. So what you're paying for, really, is a product that is basically sold as is. Any kinds of bugs and problems, security issues, there's really no liability there for that at all. And there are no real guarantees that any of those bugs or improvements or any amount of feedback that you provide, there's not really any guarantee that that's going to be acted upon. Now contrast this with free software. Well, number one, there's no amount of money that you're paying for it unless you decide to donate, which would be nice, but you're not necessarily paying for anything as is or otherwise. You're simply getting a software package that claims to be able to do a certain set of things, and if you try it and you like it and it actually does those things, then great. If you try it and it's not doing those things for you, you have the choice to choose a different software package at no loss to you. Furthermore, if it does a certain thing for 10 other people, and for some reason it's just not working for you, well, that's just how software is sometimes, depending on the system and the software and what you're doing with it. And so it's not violating any kind of implied guarantee that it's going to do something for you, that it's going to work every time. So there's a degree of honesty there, I think, that I really, really appreciate, especially when I've been doing things with commercial software packages and, you know, you're on a deadline and you're trying to do something and it simply won't. And you think, wow, I paid a lot of money for this and it's not working how it was supposed to be working, and there's absolutely nothing I can do about it. There's no one I can call, and you just feel kind of cheated. Free software also tends to be a lot less competitive in the bad way. They're competitive still because they want to be the best software, but they have no worries about whether something, if they enable, for instance, GIMP to open Photoshop files, they're not really worried about you maybe cheating sometimes and going off and using Photoshop. You could use both for all they care. Now, for Photoshop, for them to be able to admit that you may be going and using GIMP on the side, that's a big blow to their corporate and marketing roadmap. And so they will try to discourage you from using any package other than Photoshop by simply not talking to files that aren't corporately paired or partnered with Photoshop. Secondly, the support issue. There's actually support out there for free software. There's a lot more support for it, I think, than for most corporate software, because the developers and people who use the software will hire themselves out as support technicians. And so there is a place to go. And in fact, this kind of ties in with the third point. Whether it's a bug or a problem or a question or a suggestion that you have, you can actually speak sometimes directly to the programmer, ask the question or make the suggestion, and you may very well have an answer or an improvement by the end of the day. One of my favorite stories to tell is I've been playing around with the 3D modeling software Blender, which is free and open source, and it's been a great little tool for me. It's been really, really fantastic. I've been using it in Linux for a while now. Been very impressed with its performance and with how robust it is and how clever it is, how I can throw any kind of media at it and it will edit it. It's just a really good, solid software. But in terms of video editing, it lacks a few kind of standard video editing features. So I went into the IRC forum and asked around about a certain feature that I thought should be there. Next thing I knew, the programmers were asking me how it should work to a person who is used to using a video editing program. I told them. They created a patch for me, and that was at 11 a.m. or so in the morning. And by 11 p.m. that night, they'd sent me a patch to add to the functionality of the program to do exactly what I had requested for it to do. At no cost to me, they appreciated the feedback, I appreciated the feature improvement, and everyone's happy. Contrast that with the, I don't know, 35 things that I've suggested to the Final Cut Pro team, and the bug reports that I've sent to them, and zero response, and so far zero results, and you kind of start to get the idea of the difference. Now, not just anyone can open up Blender and write a patch for it, because you have to know how to program. But the people who do know how to program, anyone who knows how to program, could feasibly crack open the Blender code, make a change, and make an improvement. And then they send that improvement back to Blender, and if Blender likes it, they can include it with the next release. Final Cut, Pro, Photoshop, these kinds of big packages, not everyone can do that. Not just any programmer who says, yeah, that is a good idea. They can't do that. The software is delivered to you as is. You are not able to, and in fact, you are not allowed to change the code. That's a big drawback. It's a huge advantage that Linux has over either Apple or Windows, is the flexibility and the freedom to change the code, to modify it, to use it as they wish, and to redistribute it. It's a huge deal. And if you can get into that, then I think you'll be able to, you'll really get into Linux, and you'll like it a lot. This has been The Bad Apples, Season 2, Episode 1, Installing Fedora Linux on Your Mac. Be careful, once you go to Linux, you just might never look back. Up and coming episodes are going to include how to jump on IRC channels, navigating your Linux system, doing cool things with desktop effects, and lots more. So get into it, get Linux, and check the website for show notes and desktop art and all that kind of stuff. You can certainly email us if you need to at gort.klaatu@gmail.com. That is gort.klaatu@gmail.com. The website address is thebadapples.info. You can also hit us up at badapples.5gbfree.com. That is thebadapples.5gbfree.com or thebadapples.info.
After all, everybody should have something to be interested in.